Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 1173 of the Juice Box Podcast. Today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Maggie Mueller. She is an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology, an OBGYN, and a reconstructive pelvic surgeon. She is also the mother of a child with type 1 diabetes, and she'll be lending us her perspective today as we expand on the Grand Round series. Nothing you hear on the Juice Box Podcast should be considered advice, medical or otherwise. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your healthcare plan. If you have type 1 diabetes or are the caregiver of someone with type 1 and a U.S. resident, this is your opportunity right now from your phone or tablet to help with type 1 diabetes research. t1dexchange.org/juicebox. Head over there, answer the questions in the survey completely, and when you're done, you've helped. It's super simple, and you won't be asked one question that you don't know the answer to. t1dexchange.org/juicebox. You can help. When you place your first order for AG1 with my link, you'll get 5 free travel packs and a free year supply of vitamin D. drinkag1.com/juicebox. If you're ready to level up your diabetes care, the Diabetes Pro Tip series from the Juice Box Podcast focuses on simple strategies for living well with type 1. The Pro Tip episodes contain easy to understand concepts that will increase your knowledge of how insulin works and so much more. My daughter has had an A1C between 5.2 and 6.4 since 2014 with zero diet restrictions, and some of those years include her in college. This information works for children, adults, and for the newly diagnosed, and for those who have been struggling for years. Go to juiceboxpodcast.com and click on Diabetes Pro Tip in the menu, or head over to episode 1000 of the Juice Box Podcast to get started today with the episode Newly Diagnosed, We're Starting Over. And then continue right on to episode 1025. That's the entire Pro Tip series, episode 1000 to episode 1026. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by the insulin pump that my daughter wears, Omnipod. Learn more and get started today with the Omnipod Dash or the Omnipod 5 at my link, omnipod.com/juicebox. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by the Eversense CGM. An implantable 6-month sensor is what you get with Eversense, but you get so much more. Exceptional and consistent accuracy over 6 months, and distinct on-body vibe alerts when you're high or low. On-body vibe alerts? You don't even know what that means, do you? EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. Go find out.
Well, my name is Maggie Mueller Knutsvig. I am a mom of a type 1 son who was diagnosed almost 2 years ago, who's now 10 years old. His name is Hudson. Mm-hmm. By trade, I am a surgeon. I am a urogynecologic and reconstructive pelvic surgeon. I work at the University of Chicago, and I'm very excited to be on your podcast.
I have to tell you that I could have guessed Chicago by the last name of the man you married.
Oh, really? Right. Because it's not common in Chicago. He's from Minnesota, where everyone can pronounce that last name. You know, here when we go out to dinner, we use my last name for a reservation. Otherwise, I have to spell out every single letter.
In my mind, I was just like Wisconsin, Chicago, Minnesota, somewhere around there.
You nailed it. Yeah.
Sounds like something that would have been in a name that would have come from, like, I don't know, a Ferris Bueller movie or Planes, Trains, and Automobiles or something like that. So that's what got me there. That's what got me there. Okay. So Hudson was diagnosed 2 years ago?
About 2 years ago, February of 2022.
Okay. Okay. And how old is he now?
He's 10. So he was diagnosed at 8.
Okay. Do you have any other children?
Yes. My daughter, our daughter, Greta, is 7.
Any other type 1 in either of your families, your husband's or yours?
No. No type 1s.
Any other autoimmune stuff?
My husband, Tyler, has vitiligo. Uh-huh. I have hypothyroidism.
You guys are a little cocktail. Okay.
Yeah.
There we go. His vitiligo, very obvious? Not so much? No.
Not so much. You really, you know, maybe a little bit on his hands when he's out in the sun, but you can't really tell. Interesting. Very light complexion, blonde.
Is your hypothyroidism Hashimoto's, or have you never been tested for antibodies?
Yeah, it was Hashimoto's. I think I was tested for antibodies when the timeline is foggy now, but it was either college or medical school.
Okay. And how old are you, just for context?
I am 41.
Okay. All right. Do you manage just with a Synthroid or a Tyrosin or some sort of T4?
Yeah, I just take Synthroid.
Okay. And that's fine. Your energy is good. All that stuff is there.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, I wish I had more energy. I don't think that has anything to do with the hypothyroidism.
But I have to tell you, without a T3 supplement, a tiny little bit of Cytomel, my daughter shuts off.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Like exhaustion, can't rest, nothing. It's terrible. God, it's the smallest dose of Cytomel you can get. Is that 0.5 micrograms maybe? I'm not sure. Or 5?
I don't know.
5 mic, maybe. Huge difference for her.
Okay. I might need to look into that.
Her body carries extra weight without it, and there's no energy whatsoever.
Oh, yeah. It's terrible.
Took us years to figure it out, actually.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was Hudson's diagnosis like? Was it obvious? Because you're a doctor, right? You knew right away on the first day, I imagine.
I mean, this is where it becomes more embarrassing than anything. So this was, you know, kind of post-COVID / people were still masking at the time. What we really noticed was that he was going to the bathroom all the time. It kind of became like a little bit of a joke. We would, you know, get in the car, we would have to stop after 15 minutes. And we just thought maybe he was just drinking too much or wasn't going to the bathroom at the right times. And then it would wax and wane. It would go away. We wouldn't think much of it. Mm-hmm. He is an active kid. He's been playing hockey travel hockey since he was 7. So the monitoring of the amount of food that he was eating, I mean, he just seemed like he was a growing kid who had a really big appetite.
Yeah.
And was always on the kind of skinnier, muscular side. Looking back at it, I remember it was my husband Tyler's birthday a week and a half before he was diagnosed, and I cooked salmon. And Hudson, who was 8 at the time, he had 5 fillets of salmon that night. And I remember thinking like, wow, he really must be working out a lot, burning a lot of energy because he's eating so much. And then there were some other things, like we saw him, he was tired a lot, you know, but again, we attributed that to he's playing hockey 5 times a day. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, looking a little bit more carefully, we started to hear from the teachers at school, like, have you noticed it takes him a long time to do something? Like, he'll go to the bathroom and he'll be gone for a really long time, or we'll have to remind him to do these things, which again was easy to write off as, you know, he's an 8-year-old boy. Yeah, yeah. You know, it takes him a long time to do things. You need to remind him. So I think we went for a really long time, you know, just kind of writing off some of these symptoms until the night he was diagnosed. I think Tyler had gotten, he was at home. I was at work. I was actually in the OR. I had finished my cases and he had told me, you know, we really need to like test his urine. I thought maybe he had a UTI because he was going to the bathroom so much. And so I was going to bring home some urine test strips. And then Tyler called me to just make sure that I was already in my car. I was downtown and I had forgotten the urine test strips, but I turned around, I went back up to my office. I grabbed the urine test strips, went home. It was a Thursday night and, you know, had Hudson, you know, pee in a cup to see if he had a UTI. And when I took the urine test strip out, like it didn't have any signs of infection. There were no white blood cells. The nitrate was negative and it was just positive for like the largest amount of ketones and the largest amount of sugar. So I, you know, being a stupid surgeon, texted some of my family medicine friends that I went to medical school with and said, you know, is there any other reason to have, you know, sugar and ketones in your urine? And most of them replied, no, it's that's really abnormal. It sounds like it could be diabetes. And then the next thing was, is this an emergency? Can I, you know, wait until the morning? And it just so happened that another one of my friends that I reached out to, her friend was an ER doctor at Lurie's Children's Hospital in Chicago and said, you need to pack a bag. You need to come to the hospital. He's going to get admitted. So all of this was happening actually when my sister and her children were making a surprise visit to come visit me for my 40th birthday.
Oh, surprise.
Yeah. So she honestly walked through the door right after I had tested his urine and was figuring out that he was diabetic. And her kids are the same age as my kids. So we have this video where, like, I'm in the background probably crying. And, you know, the kids are all just like hugging and embracing. They used to live here and then they moved to Charleston, South Carolina. And then, you know, she walked in further and saw that there was something wrong in order to get Hudson. Now, in the midst of all this, before we went to the hospital, so my family, my parents were at our house too, because they knew my sister was coming in to surprise us. So I sent my dad to the Walgreens to get a glucometer. But unfortunately, the first time he came back with just the glucometer, then he came back with just test strips and something else. I mean, he went there three times and I said, like, just go talk to the pharmacist and ask, you know, what exactly do you need to take somebody's blood sugar? So finally he came back after the third time and we took Hudson's blood sugar and it was like 590 or something like that.
When you tested all your friends, Matt, or texted all your friends, did you know it was diabetes and you were just hoping it could be something else, or did you really not know?
No, I mean, I really was, I was caught so off guard. I thought that he, you know, had a UTI.
Yeah.
So I was You were taken aback.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't certain because I don't know if, like, I mean, I guess people would listen from the outside and think you're a surgeon. Like you put it together. You said, oh, I have Hashimoto's. My husband has vitiligo. These are all autoimmune diseases, but that's not how it works. You're just a regular person in that moment.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, until Hudson was diagnosed, I didn't really equate type 1 diabetes with autoimmune diseases. So that wasn't even like on my radar at all. Mm-hmm. I just knew, I mean, I think I knew it's not normal to have, you know, sugar in your urine, to be spilling sugar in your urine, and it's not normal to have ketones in your urine. I just was kind of hoping that it was potentially something else and probably clinging to a little bit of hope, but I definitely wasn't putting all of that together.
This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by the only 6-month wear implantable CGM on the market. And it's very unique. So you go into an office, I've actually seen an insertion done online, like a live one, they recorded it. The entire video is less than 8 minutes long and they're talking most of the time. The insertion took no time at all, right? So you go into the office, they insert the sensor. Now it's in there and working for 6 months. You go back 6 months later, they pop out that one, put in another one. So 2 office visits a year to get really accurate and consistent CGM data. But that's neither here nor there for what I'm trying to say. So this thing's under your skin, right? And you then wear a transmitter over top of it. Transmitter's got this nice, gentle silicone adhesive that you change daily. So very little chance of having skin irritations. That's a plus. So you put the transmitter on, it talks to your phone app, tells you your blood sugar, your alerts, your alarms, etc. But if you want to be discreet for some reason, you take the transmitter off, just swoop, comes right off. No, like, you know, not like peeling at it or having to rub off adhesive. It just kind of pops right off. This silicone stuff, really cool. You'll say it. And now you're ready for your big day, whatever that day is. It could be a prom or a wedding or just a moment when you don't want something hanging on your arm. The Eversense CGM allows you to do that without wasting a sensor because you just take the transmitter off and then when you're ready to use it again, you pop it back on. Maybe you just want to take a shower without rocking a sensor with a bar of soap. Just remove the transmitter and put it back on when you're ready. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. You really should check it out. Members of my private Facebook group are constantly posting about how much they love Omnipod 5. Maybe you've seen those posts and thought, I wish I could have that experience with an insulin pump. If you've had those feelings, you might be experiencing FUMU, fear of missing out on Omnipod. Symptoms of FUMU may include, but are not limited to, wishing you could wear outfits without pockets, dreaming about walking past doorknobs without getting your tubing caught, fantasizing about jumping into a swimming pool without disconnecting from your insulin pump first. Well, I've got good news. You don't have to suffer from FUMU any longer. You can see what you're missing by trying Omnipod 5 for yourself. Visit Omnipod.com/juicebox to get started. For full safety and risk information, also visit Omnipod.com/juicebox. There are links to Eversense, Omnipod, and all the sponsors in the show notes of your podcast player and at juiceboxpodcast.com. You know, it's funny. Yesterday, this is such an odd story, but yesterday I was standing in line paying for my Christmas tree. And this young woman, like probably 30 years old, was off to my right. She was talking to a couple of people. And I guess her husband was ahead of me in line. So she calls past me, like over me to him. "Hey, honey, what's that thing I have?" That's what she said to him. And he turns to her and he goes, "What?" And she goes, "You know, my cold fingers. What's that syndrome I have?" And he goes, "Raynaud's?" Like that. And she goes, "Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah." And she turns back to the, and she keeps talking. And she kind of made eye contact with me. And I said, "Hey, does anybody else in your family have any autoimmune diseases?" And she looked at me and I said, like, you know, celiac or diabetes or anything like that. And she gets this look on her face like, "Holy hell, are you from the future?" And, you know, like, and she's like, "My sister has celiac and my mom has type 1 diabetes. And I went, "Okay, wait, stop." She goes, "How did you know that?" And I said, "Well, I didn't know. I was just guessing." But I said, "What you just said, Raynaud's, it's an autoimmune issue. And sometimes they run in families. So celiac and so is type 1. And the friends she was talking to looked at me like, "He must be a television doctor." And I was,
and it was just, I love that.
It was just very, it was such an odd moment and very funny. But the whole story is about the look on her face. Like, how would you know that possibly? And then it's funny because I think, how do you not know that? But then I realize I'm the only one making this podcast. So like it, you know, it does make sense. Wow. So, okay. I've got the scene set. Your family has just arrived. Your father is inept at best. No offense to him.
And, I mean, I love him to death and he was so helpful and he did go back three times. But you know,
how did he raise a surgeon? You. I know we're all wondering it. And so so like this is all happening. You're really like you're distraught, would you say?
Yes. Yeah. At this time.
How's Hudson?
He's also hysterical because we wanted to prick his finger and get, you know, the blood sugar. And, you know, this is another, like, I didn't know how to do this. So I had whatever Lancet my dad had come back at, from whatever visit back to the pharmacy, whichever, you know, series was 1, 2, or 3. I mean, I think I like really jabbed his finger to get blood to come out. So he was hysterical from that. And then I didn't read the directions, of course. And I don't think that I had assembled everything correctly the first time. So then I had to do it again. So he was hysterical just with the finger pricking. And then when we needed to go to the hospital, you know, he was hysterical about that. So we actually I had to put my nephew in the car along with Hudson and drag both of them to the ER. Because Hudson wouldn't go without his nephew or without his cousin. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where things started.
How it started. So once you get to the ER and they get him admitted and you're in a room, do you suddenly think, well, I'm trained on this. I went to medical school. Like, or do you feel as lost as everybody else in that moment?
Well, I remember being happy. So I remember the first thing, it was very quick. You know, even in a very busy ER, when I went and told whoever was taking intake what we were there for, I mean, we got, you know, shuttled into a triage room. We didn't wait at all when I said that his blood sugar was, you know, 500 something. And I remember they did an ABG, not a real ABG, but whatever they must fit, poke your finger, not the way that we used to have to get arterial blood gases. And they knew that he wasn't acidotic. So I was happy that he wasn't in DKA, but it turns out, you know, I guess the term they use is DK no A. So he was ketotic, but not acidotic. So I remember being happy that he didn't have DKA because I knew that was going to change things a little bit. But no, I remember being really still kind of dumbfounded. The nurse and we might have seen a resident and then another faculty from the endocrinology team that night when we were still in the ER. And I remember them asking about family history and, you know, Tyler has some type 2 diabetes on his family, but no one had type 1. And we were just, you know, we didn't really realize that this could happen. Mm-hmm. And I still wasn't even exactly sure, you know, I think they gave him a little bit of insulin IV through, you know, they had him on a drip for a little bit and then made a plan to kind of transition him the next day. But I mean, I didn't know what was happening at all, basically.
Were you about to say you didn't, at that point, you didn't even realize he was going to need insulin through his life?
No, I knew he was going to need insulin, okay. But I didn't really know what that was going to look like acutely. You know, how are they going to get him through this acute situation?
Right. Your husband goes with you. Does everyone else come or who's in the hospital with you?
So my Ty was driving. He was probably parking when I brought him up there the first, you know, very quickly. Yes, it was COVID. So they were strict about things still at the time. So we were all together. Tyler was there. And then I had my poor nephew, Fox, with me because Hudson wouldn't go by himself. So all four of us were in this room until my sister was able to kind of coax her son back home.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, yeah. So that the things can start happening and everyone's not completely knocked off kilter by this. And by the way, how crazy that that's on a family visit from like cross country.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was just like, how could this be happening? And
yeah, did that end up being helpful that she was there?
It was so helpful. I think that it was helpful that she did help with a lot. My sister's not medical, but she helped with a ton of things at home. You know, I think that we obviously would have not wanted any of this to be happening, but she was really helpful. I think my mom was also very nervous at the time, so it was helpful to have my sister there. She's very level-headed and just kind of was ready to say like, okay, what do we need to do to make this work?
It's nice that I found it helpful to have support. Even when we just got home, my mother-in-law came and cleaned the whole house. I think she didn't know what else to do. And and she was like, what would help you? And I remember saying, if the house was clean and the laundry was done, I think I could like focus on this for a couple of days. Like she came to our house, like cleaned everything, did the laundry. I was like, oh my gosh, it's the only good thing that came out of Arden's diabetes. Five preloads of laundry. Okay. So he's admitted now, things are moving along. They're getting his blood sugar to come down. Now the education starts.
Yes.
And so, I mean, I have you on here to hear your story, but I also want to hear from you. I think you have an insight that a lot of people don't have. So, you know, when you hear people come on this podcast and it's a crapshoot, right? Either somebody says, I got a great doctor and they actually were great, or they are like, oh my God, my doctor didn't teach me anything. Like there's not usually a lot of in between. Like sometimes there's people who are a little overwhelmed, so they don't absorb everything. Or sometimes people give doctors a ton of credit. And then as I talk to them, I'm like, I don't understand. Like your A1C is 8.5 and you've had diabetes for 6 years, but you're sitting here telling me that you have a great endocrinologist. How can that be? And then when they really pick through it, they go, oh, well, yeah, I guess maybe I like them a lot. And then you find out that people judge their doctors by if they like them, not really as much about their outcomes, which is fascinating. But I'm trying to figure out, what do doctors know? What should they know? And is there a way that we can get that information to them? And I think you're in an incredibly unique situation, maybe to walk through that a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, from our experience, I think it is the acute diagnosis period requires so much support during the education. So it should be prefaced that, you know, Hudson was highly motivated to get out of the hospital. So, I mean, every single time anyone came into the room, he asked, when can I go home? And, you know, being medical, I knew that it was Friday. Nothing was going to happen over the weekend. Like there wouldn't be any education. I understood they told us what needed to happen, that we needed to meet with the diabetic educator, that we need to meet with the nutritionist. And I was worried that none of this stuff would happen before the weekend and we would be there until Monday, et cetera.
Sure.
So they were actually very helpful and we were able to get fast tracked. We got the Dexcom in the hospital. Tyler, you know, ran over to the Apple store and bought a phone because we understood that that was the way that we needed to, you know, track the blood sugar. So we got a phone that day. And we were able to be discharged Friday night. So It was very, very quick.
Who the hell told you about a Dexcom on your first day?
So the diabetic educator said wow. that, you know, one of the things they were waiting, they wanted to make sure that all the prescriptions were going through, and, you know, they had put the Dexcom prescription through. And so, you know, once we had the phone, she was going to come in and show us how to use the Dexcom.
No kidding. Wow. He had it on his first day.
Yeah. So that I'm very, when I hear people say that they left the hospital without a Dexcom, I mean, I'm floored. I don't know how you would deal with that.
Can I ask you, I'm sorry, some people find this very personal, but I'm just very interested because you had it on the first day. What's his A1C 3 months later?
I think it probably was like in the sevens, I want to say.
That's fair. Has it gone down since then?
It has. I mean, and that was another thing. So we didn't start off on a pump right away. I think it was probably 6 weeks before we got on the dash. And then I remember in June, we got on the Omnipod.
Five?
Yeah, Omnipod 5. Okay. Yeah.
And that's just this past June. So he had diabetes for a few months, maybe a couple of months MDI, then using a manual pump with dash. And now for the last 4 or 5 months, he's had an algorithm.
No, sorry. So he was on DASH, I think, in April, right after his diagnosis. And then June after his diagnosis, we switched him to Omnipod 5.
Oh, that quickly. Okay.
All right. Yeah, I really wanted that, you know, immediately for the night. We had a lot of lows with the DASH at nighttime. Mm-hmm. So
how'd you find out about the algorithm?
I'm sure. I mean, my husband and I both listened to your podcast a lot. I think we found out a ton of information. Also, you know, we're very thankful for this. So at the time, Hudson, one of his hockey teammates, his older brother, I did not know this beforehand, but his older brother had type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. I think he was 13 at the time. So I had, you know, spoken to the mom once her son had seen, you know, us doing some, I mean, I might have been like giving him some insulin or something like that. And so we learned a little bit more about looping because her son was looping at the time. And that sounded very intriguing, but I think we were so overwhelmed with everything at that point in time. Like there was no way that we were going to be able to figure that out.
I understand that. Yeah.
Kind of where we were. Mm-hmm. And I also was just trying to understand, you know, what the hesitancy, you know, right after diagnosis to getting a kid on a pump. I didn't really understand why there's any waiting period. Like, why was there any MDI for whatever purpose? And I understood, like, yeah, you have to know how to do that for backup, but it just seemed like if there is a better way, why wouldn't we be pursuing the better way? So that was, you know, difficult for me, you know, as a parent to know that there was something which I perceived to be better. And it wasn't really clear why we couldn't start with that right off the bat.
I keep thinking that I would have loved to have seen the Apple employee's face when he was like, tried to be upbeat with your husband. He was like, so you're getting the new phone, huh?
Yeah.
Your husband's like, just take the credit card and let me get the hell out of here.
Exactly. Yeah. Well,
yeah, this is not a big happy moment, my friend. Right. That, yeah, that's crazy. How do you find out about the podcast?
Actually, someone who was on your podcast, who actually lives in our neighborhood, told us about the podcast. So she was on the podcast where her daughter was diagnosed at camp in Maine. So,
Oh yeah. And she had to fly to Maine. Mm-hmm. That person lives in your neighborhood?
Well, she lives like, you know, we live in Glencoe. It's very small. So it's like 8,000 people. So,
well, that's even crazier, Maggie. I interviewed somebody that lives in a group of 8,000 people and they know you and they helped you with your diabetes for your kid.
I mean, we met all these people kind of around the same time. So, you know, Hudson, I think he took a week off of school. And when he went back, he didn't want to tell anyone. The teacher asked, do you want to tell your classmates about it? And he said no. And then he reconsidered. And then I heard later that day from a mom who has a daughter in Hudson's class, who she came back home and told her parents that Hudson has type 1 diabetes because her parents have type 1 diabetes. So then they reached out and kind of set us up with, I mean, I think we had like 3 to 4 people at least that we were speaking with right off the bat, you know, in Glencoe. And then another person that was kind of, you know, we called her like the diabetes fairy, who was also in the community and was helping us a lot in the hospital and making sure that we had like the right lancets and things like that. I mean, I'm very thankful and we're all very grateful that we live in such a supportive community. But yeah, we had a bunch of people to talk to right off the bat that either had type 1 diabetes themselves or their children had it.
So between the people you were lucky enough to meet and this podcast and doctors, where's the most help come from?
I think we all would have been really struggling without the support of the community that, you know, these, I think there were four or five individuals that were extremely helpful and that pointed us in the direction of the podcast. It just allowed us, you know, we learned so much about it. And, you know, Tyler is not medical, so he learned a ton about it. You know, we listen to it all the time. I listen to it on the way to work. I mean, it was really helpful. I think it's a hard pill to swallow when you leave the hospital. We left the hospital and we were set up with an endocrinologist in 3 months. And that is really scary.
Yeah.
The team was great. I mean, we called the nurses when we needed to check in and they would, you know, change things, but it was really nerve-wracking not having, you know, that appointment for so long.
Yeah. That's actually kind of uncommon for children.
Yeah.
Like for adults, it's very common, but for children, it's not usually.
Yeah. And we're also lucky because our endocrinologist lives in our neighborhood. So we did have that, you know, she's been very helpful and was able to expedite everything. And, you know, she's our neighbor. So we benefited a lot.
Do you kind of see the podcast and people as sort of one group, like a community feeling?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, so not only is it a 3 month wait to get to the endocrinologist, by the way, you don't have any pull? What happened there?
Jeez, no, yeah.
Oh, what good is it being a doctor?
Oh, I know. Well, that I think is what really made me very nervous for lots of families. So yeah,
that's my next question is how do you think that people who aren't you fare in this situation?
Yeah, not well. It was really eye-opening. I'm a quality of life surgeon. I deal with zero things that are life-threatening, but we have these metrics where like, I need to be able to see a new patient in 1 week or we get dinged. I just didn't understand how, you know, a child with a life-threatening illness was given an appointment 3 months later. Yeah. That seemed kind of crazy to me. And we are thankful that we had connections and great people to advocate for us. And we were able to get in there sooner, but I realized that many people don't. And even, you know, they might not have the background information that we had, mm-hmm. you know, when you.
God, does that happen? Maggie, do you get to the doctor 3 months later and find out you've learned more in the last 3 months than they're able to tell you?
I mean, I think that by the time we ended up seeing our endocrinologist, I don't even really remember the first appointment that we went to, and I think we were just trying to understand what exactly did we need to do in order to get the pump. I mean, I feel like that's what the entire...
It's about how to get around the insurance system.
Yeah, it was just, you know, what steps needed to happen in order to get the pump.
Did you have to ask any questions at that point? I mean, you're still a 7A1C, 7.5, so you're not killing it or anything like that. So did you come in with questions that they were able to answer for you?
Well, I remember there was a great, at the time, the nurse that was there, I feel like she also had type 1 diabetes, or she might have, yeah, she was the nurse educator that worked with our doctor. She kind of leveled with us a lot, but a lot of the problems that we were having with the MDI was just, you know, he would basically just not want to eat anything that required an injection. So he would come home from school and, you know, he probably wanted to eat a snack, but he didn't want to eat any, he didn't want a cheese stick or a salami stick. And I don't think that he wanted to have an injection. So he would just say that he wasn't hungry.
Yeah.
And then other things that are so much better dealt with a pod or pump, you know, when he was going to have anything that required split dosing, it was also very difficult because he would not want to have a second injection.
Right.
So we were struggling with these things that I think when you're talking to somebody who's been on a pump for a really long time, it's almost hard to even like remember, oh, how do you deal with all that?
Yeah. You know, the other day, Arden started using, am I going to talk about this on the podcast? Yeah, sure. Why the hell not? I wasn't sure if I was ready or not for this one, but I can say this much about it for now. I don't have enough details to be more valuable at the moment, but Arden began using a GLP the other day. Mm-hmm. And it's just the first injection. And I know I've talked about it on here enough that people who listen know Arden's like doesn't like needles.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, she has given herself one insulin injection in her entire life. That's it. That, maybe as a little kid, but like she one that she recalls. And she was getting ready to go away to college. And I said, listen, in case there's a catastrophic failure of all of our technology, I need you to be able to inject insulin.
Yeah.
So your next correction today, like go ahead and draw it up in this syringe and give it to yourself. And I'm still trying to get her on here to talk about that process. But I'm telling you, she sat in the bathroom with the door closed for 90 minutes before she came out and said, I did it. And she looked like she had run with the bulls by the time she came out. Like yeah. she just came out like she was in a car wreck, then a bull chased her, and then someone picked her up in a helicopter and dropped her on the ground, and then she was alive somehow. And she's like, I did it. And I'm like, oh okay. So the other day she has to get this injection, and she's like, whoa. I'm like, Arden, come on. And she did it, and it wasn't that big of a deal. But I'm gonna tell you that she defended herself three times with her hand as I came in with the GLP pen.
Yeah.
Like not like harshly, but she reached out and defended herself, like almost uncontrollably.
Yeah.
And so I get when people don't want to, my daughter's had diabetes for 15 years. I get when people don't like needles, you know, like I really do. And she still, every time she inserts something, she's like, come on. And I've come to realize it's not about the pain. It's about, she's averse to the process. She just really is. So, but for people to hear, the real story here is there are people, children, adults, who are not eating the way they should because they're trying to avoid injections.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. And that's, you know, a tough fact, but it needs to be heard by physicians, I think. I'm sorry, I took you off balance there, but.
No, that's, and I think another thing, and I think we're all really, you know, everyone, but specifically physicians, nurses, we're just always very careful about what we say. And now I know how careful we need to be. When we were in the hospital, I think it was a diabetic educator who told me that, you know, they're 95% he has type 1 diabetes or diabetes, but there's a 5% chance that he doesn't. And so I was like waiting at home to hear what these antibody results were, because I thought that it meant there was a 5% chance that we were wrong and he doesn't have diabetes at all. Mm-hmm. And so they called me back to let me know that like every single antibody was positive, but also, oh yeah, he has hypothyroidism too. But when we were told that over the phone, because obviously we'd been discharged from the hospital, whoever called us said, well, don't worry, it's not as bad as type 1 diabetes.
Oh, like, so the person called to go, hey, I'm just calling with test results. You have hypothyroidism, but don't worry, that's not nearly as bad as type 1. And you're like, oh, we got that too. Thanks.
At that time, I was crying. You know, it was just like another thing.
Yeah.
And I know that it's not as bad as type 1 diabetes, but he also has that.
Look harder at the chart before you try to make me feel better.
Yeah. So I was just like, oh gosh, you know, it's just one of those things. Like I was clinging on to this potential 5% chance doesn't have diabetes.
5% chance that it was what?
I think they meant, looking back at it, I think they meant type 2 diabetes because they hadn't gotten the confirmatory antibodies back.
Oh, that's not that. So you took way more hope in that than they meant.
Oh, yeah. I thought that there was a 5% chance that he was like fully misdiagnosed and this was going to be not happening.
Yeah. Have you ever heard me talk about when that happened to me?
No.
Arden had this weird honeymoon.
Oh.
It lasted like 2.5 or 3 days. Where she just needed her basal insulin and nothing for food. Mm-hmm. And was getting low. And I waited like 2 days into it. I called my friend who's a pediatrician. And I knew, by the way, I knew it wasn't true, but I wanted it to be true so badly. But I hedged my bets and I started the conversation. I wonder if he remembers me calling him. And I said, I know I'm wrong. Just tell me to get off the phone. But here's what's happening. Is it possible Arden doesn't have diabetes? And he's like, she's had it for like 2 years or like it had been like a long time. And he goes, no, she has diabetes. And I was like, okay, thank you. And he goes, hang up. And I'm like, I will. And I just got off the phone. But I had that feeling. I know the exact feeling you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like when you've got a scratcher in your hand.
And
you're like, I'm not going to work again if this is just a club. Damn it.
Exactly.
Terrible. Oh, I'm so sorry.
No. And then after that wore off, it was my, you know, I had heard about teplizumab and the trials that were going on. So I was desperate to find, you know, a trial that was still enrolling, you know, so I knew that University of Chicago was a site. So I emailed all the people there and it just so happened that they had stopped enrolling his age group, you know, a couple months beforehand. So then I was devastated that we didn't have that option. So yeah. There were just a lot of ups and downs in that period.
Any guilt in here when he has hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's, you do too?
I don't think I even put that together. I think that...
Oh, sorry. Am I introducing this for the first time? I didn't mean
no,
to.
No. Okay. No. I mean, at that period of time, I don't think I did, you know, I think probably honestly, when we were in the hospital and if anyone asked about autoimmune, I don't even think both Tyler and I would have come up with he probably wouldn't have talked about vitiligo and I probably wouldn't have talked about hypothyroidism. You know, I've had it for so long and I just didn't.
It's like a vitamin you take, I would imagine at this point, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't, you know, a lot of guilt. I think that, again, being so close around COVID. So I remember when we were leaving to the hospital, my mother, who I also love to pieces, you know, said, do you think this has something to do with the COVID vaccine? Because my kids had been vaccinated so that they could go back to school. And so then I carried this guilt around that potentially it was the COVID vaccine that caused the type 1 diabetes. So, you know, I had to be the person in the hospital to ask the doctor like the embarrassing question, you know, is this at all related to the COVID vaccine? And I remember her saying, this is probably based on his A1C. It's probably been going on for a year. So, you know, yeah. And he had the COVID vaccine like a couple months beforehand. So then that reassured me a little bit more.
I mean, and honestly, if there's anything there, I mean, maybe the virus from the vaccine, like, sped up the process, but it sounds like the process has been going on for a very long time, first of all. And, you know, I mean, viruses do bring on diagnosis, but they don't, it's so hard to know if people understand how that works or not when they hear it. It's not, I sneezed, and so I got type 1 diabetes.
Yes, exactly.
Sneezes cause type 1 diabetes. It's, I was going to get type 1 diabetes, and did you know sneezes speed it up?
Yeah.
That's the vibe, but what you hear people say is, you know, viruses cause type 1. Viruses don't cause type 1. Viruses can cause type 1 in people who were predisposed and already at some point in their life likely going to get type 1 diabetes. It's a different, like, I guess it's like once you have it, it's who cares what came first. But it when it's spoken about, it gets spoken about colloquially. And I think it gives people the idea that, oh, you know, you just get a thing and then that happens. Like it's cause and effect, but it's hard to explain sometimes.
Well, yeah, especially because there is this increase. And so people oftentimes ask, you know, why are there so many more kids with type 1 diabetes now?
Right.
And I think everybody does want to have an explanation. And then it gets this game of telephone, like all of these potential things that cause type 1 diabetes.
When somebody says to me, what do you make of all the type 1 increased diagnosis during COVID? I say, yeah, there's a lot of people out there walking around with antibodies who at some point in their life were going to get type 1 diabetes. And it just so happened there's a virus that covered the whole planet. And so they all got it at the same time. Doesn't mean COVID gave them type 1 diabetes.
Right.
Yeah. And so, I don't know, it's just a hard thing. And then people, they don't like to believe some people are like, no, that's not what happened. I'm like, oh, okay, I don't know what to say. You know, so, I mean, my daughter had Coxsackie virus and then got type 1. If I say that on the podcast 3 episodes in a row, I'm going to get 5 emails about like a day about, oh, my kid had a Coxsackie virus before they got type 1. Yeah, it's a virus. You get your kid, just like my kid, had antibodies, they got a virus and their immune system was like, hey, I'm confused. And then, you know, here we go. So
exactly.
That's kind of what it is. Sucks. I'll tell you that much. He's doing well. Hudson is, right?
Yes. Now,
you know, needle phobias, like that stuff's not an issue with you think if you went back to needles, though, do you think he'd be like, I'm not hungry? No, thank you.
Yes. So we've had, you know, a variety of incidents that have required, you know, the potential for injections.
Sure.
So most recently he was in a sailing camp. I bought some very expensive waterproof fanny pack to keep his phone and PDM in, which works very well if you zip it closed. So, you know, he zipped it closed, or he thought he zipped it closed. He, you know, capsized, and, you know, this was, I had sent him to a sailing camp, which is about an hour and 15 minutes away. My parents have a house on a lake there, and, you know, that's where the yacht club is, and he was sailing there, but I was working in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I get a call from my mom that this happened. She's going to take the PDM home and put it in the dryer to see if, you know, she can fix it because it wasn't working. So obviously I asked her not to put it in the dryer.
I was going to ask which one of your parents you took after being a surgeon, but I think it's possible you might be adopted.
Always very helpful and, you know, trying to do the right thing. But obviously it was very much broken.
Maggie, what if I put the phone on the grill and see if I can dry it out?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't even like rice or anything. It was in the dryer.
That's fantastic.
It didn't go in the dryer, but I told her, you know, if he's going to, I knew it was this last day of sailing and there was going to be pizza. So I said, you know, he's going to need an injection if he eats anything. Okay. Yeah. So I get in my car. We actually had a backup PDM, thankfully. I get in my car to go to manage that, which I also was listening to the podcast at that point in time because I had to reset the PDM. So I was wondering, like, what did I need to change based on the algorithm? What should I put in? So I was, you know, taking the crash course. And I think there was one episode that you had that was resetting the something similar had happened and someone was talking about how they managed that.
Right.
But the long story short, you know, he was told not to eat before getting an injection. And, you know, I got a picture on my phone from my mom, which showed like two half-eaten pizzas and pieces of pizza and a popsicle or something that he just went ahead and ate without, you know, taking any insulin for.
Did he do that on his own, Maggie, or did your mom not have the fortitude to stop him? Do you know what happened? Will you ever find out?
Yeah, I think he was on his own and just made a conscious decision that he was going to eat these pieces of pizza and have this popsicle without any insulin. So then his blood sugar, of course, like over 400. He ultimately, you know, they convinced him to take an injection. And then, you know, I was able to restart the pod and get things working.
Yeah. How about that? Jeez.
Yeah.
Well, good times. You say here that you sent me a note before you were on. You said physicians need to know that this is a chronic disease that requires constant manipulation and reliance on pharmacies, technology, doctors, nurses. And all this can change, and that it also all affects the aspects of your life, different aspects of your life. I wondered, do you have a message? Like if you could talk to other physicians, and are you talking about endos and everyone else or everyone else?
I do think that endocrinologists probably know this best, that it does take so much care coordination. I don't think many other physicians know that. You know, they see like, oh, you're on a prescription for insulin. Let me make sure you get your prescription for insulin. But there are so many other things that go into this. And I also think like there was absolutely no way. I did not know. I think we both, Tyler and I, struggled with this. We thought it was a mathematic equation. Like, I'm going to eat this many carbs. I'm going to cover with this much insulin and like my blood sugar will be perfect. And we had no idea that there were variables that existed that were going to, you know, make it so that no meal will ever be the same. No activity is ever going to behave the same. I had no idea about that. And I don't think a lot of people know about that, and let alone, you know, like specific, maybe endocrinologists, but not other physicians for sure. And I think it's, you know, easy to say, like, why isn't your hemoglobin A1C better? Aren't you taking your insulin? And there's just so much more to that. The way that this affects caregivers, the actual patient that has diabetes, there are a lot of, you know, Hudson I would describe as happy-go-lucky type child. when we left the hospital that day, he asked, he was super excited to leave the hospital. And his comment was, well, because I don't have to take another shot. You really just don't understand what you're dealing with and the amount of rationalization that can happen, but also the way that it affects just, you know, he wanted to be a normal kid. He wanted to keep playing all the things that he did. I think that we had him in a hockey game the morning after he was diagnosed from the hospital, and we were trying to manage his blood sugar, less than 12 hours outside of the hospital in a hockey game. It really does affect kids. It changes everything. You know, he has to go to the nurse and carry this bag and all these things that I think that Ty and I were like, well, this isn't going to change your life at all. We minimize the fact that it definitely has changed your life and you have to do things a little bit more or sometimes harder than some of your friends do. And I think that that was something that we neglected to validate, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Who says to you, you mentioned, how come your A1C is not better? Why is your time range? Are you not using your insulin? Have you gotten messaging like that from doctors? Or did you say?
I mean, I've probably been someone who said that as a doctor, you know, just being completely naive about what is required to improve your hemoglobin A1C. I mean, in my field of work, it's elective surgery. So I never operated on anyone with a hemoglobin A1C of under or over 8. That was like a hard cutoff. And, you know, we would cancel surgeries. And I think I probably did have an attitude like in a nice way, but you need to get your hemoglobin A1C down better. And like, are you taking insulin? I mean, that's just very...
It never occurred to you to say, this person's struggling, maybe I should help them get their A1C down. Like, that's not how any of this works, right? Like, they'll have to figure that out.
Well, like, and work with your endocrinologist or work with your primary care doctor. And honestly, probably neither of those things is going to change things that much. They just needed to, there were probably many things that were affecting their hemoglobin A1C.
Right.
And I was blissfully unaware of all the different things that need to happen in order to successfully manage diabetes.
Can you explain to a regular person, a person who is not a physician, has not been to medical school, doesn't work in a hospital, a doctor's office, et cetera, why it is that they shouldn't expect their surgeon, who's going to work on their pelvic floor or whatever, to understand diabetes? Why do other doctors besides endocrinologists not understand type 1? I mean, they don't understand a lot of different things, and which you and I understand to be reasonable, but to the outside person, just a regular person who looks up and says, that's a doctor. Why in the hell don't they understand? You're in a very siloed profession. Is that correct?
Yeah. I'm like, I always tell people I do like 7 surgeries and that's it. So I am so siloed. And I also, I don't have a background in internal medicine where you would probably practically learn so much about that. So I'm relying on things that I learned in medical school. Lots has changed, right? I mean, the insulin is different. Pumps are really mainstay now. So it's really difficult for people who are not in it every day to be keeping up with this. And I think, yes, I would hope that doctors have a cursory understanding of type 1 diabetes. I think most of them could tell you the difference between type 2. They could probably come up with some other types of diabetes. And certainly they know that when your blood sugar is high, you need insulin. When it's low, you need sugar, which, that seemed like...
But that's acute stuff. And that's probably all they know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I did not mean to use a... I'm going to use a word. I did not mean to use a douchey corporate terminology just then. Silo just means like isolated.
Oh, no. Yeah.
No, I just realized when I said it, I was like, that's just a thing I hear my wife say.
No, it didn't come off to me that way.
Okay,
I am really siloed, for sure.
When you're so isolated, I guess a more real world way of saying it might be that, I don't know, the offensive lineman on your favorite football team doesn't know what the cornerback is doing. And,
yeah.
And not only don't they play corner ever, but they're not even in the defensive meetings. They don't even know what the defense is doing. They know what they're doing. They've learned a job and they do it over and over again. Just like you, I run block to the left. I run block to the right. I pass block for the left. I do 7 different surgeries. It's fun to say, like, what kind of doctor are you again?
I'm a urogynecologist, reconstructive pelvic surgeon. It's a mouthful.
Oh, see, but when you say that, also, there's a joke in there. It's inappropriate because you're such a nice person. But But
I hear a lot. Don't worry.
I bet you do. But like there, when that's your title and that's what you do, and then I hear you say in plain English, I really only do 7 different surgeries. I bet you that's not a thing people would think of you. They probably think you're a magician, a wizard. Do you know what I mean? Because of that title and how long that in their mind they believe you've gone to medical school. I mean, what? Think about it. What'd you do? You did your undergrad.
It's a long time.
Yeah,
I went to medical school for 4 years. I did residency for 4 years, and then I did a 3-year surgical fellowship.
That's 11 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So you went to school for 11 years to learn how to do 7 surgeries.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then if I say to you, how does type 1 diabetes work? You go, sugar makes you high, insulin brings it down. Type 1 is, I think it might be genetic. Is it auto? I that's where you'd be stuck if I went and found you 3-4 years ago, right?
Yeah, I would have known that. Like, I would have associated type 1 with insulin dependent. Like, that's what I would have associated at the time.
Okay. Now I'm going to ask you to be, I don't know if this is fair or not. We'll see if you're comfortable doing this. If I asked you to, so there, we've addressed why most people in the medical field don't understand it. It's not something they know. But if people are with an endocrinologist or a nurse practitioner for diabetes, these kinds of like jobs, and they're not getting good information from them, how does that happen? So even take it out of diabetes, like forget diabetes for a second. I shouldn't have asked it that way. How does it happen that some doctors with 11 years of practice still aren't very adept at what they're doing? And how common is that?
I mean, I can't really speak for like we've had such a good experience our endocrinologist, right. And I don't have enough experience with, you know, I hear something sometimes like on the Facebook podcast and it is concerning. Like I don't really know why some would be less, you know, forthcoming or in the mix. In my own specialty, I think that, you know, my specialty requires fellowship training, that 3-year training, and also board certification in this fellowship. So it's a sub-specialized board certification. And I think possibly, if I had to guess, maybe the people who are getting that subpar care are just not seeing those specialists.
Could it be the communication piece? Because it occurs to me as you're talking, you don't have to communicate to anybody to do your job really well. Like you don't, like, you'll sit the person down and say, look, here's what we're going to do. You know, this is what's happening. I don't know how you say it in your lady parts, and we're going to do this. And then we're going to do that. And this is what's going to alleviate. It's going to bring this to your life. It's going to take me about this long. Here's how long recovery is. You know, I have, you probably brag about like your infection rate being low or something like that. Then you kick, you kick them out of the room and you put them on the schedule. You do the thing for them and they end up okay. Not, you know, moreover.
I don't have many long-term relationships with my patients.
Right. But you don't have to explain anything to them for them to maintain that work that you've done for them. So you're more of a, gosh, I don't mean this pejoratively, but you're more of a, you're swinging a hammer, really. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas I'm expecting an endocrinologist to help me with my diabetes by being able to initially communicate what I need to know, to watch me grow or not grow and re-communicate things or move me along and teach me, and to picture what's happening when they're not around and then accurately make adjustments to me without fairly even being able to see what I do day to day. And some people are good at that and some people aren't. It's more of a job of communication than it is of medicine, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And I think that there are so many constraints right now on people in the medical profession, you know, physicians, nurse practitioners, et cetera. I mean, when I'm at those endocrinology appointments, the amount of stuff that has to happen, there's a lot of stuff that has to happen. You know, they review the Dexcom reports and things like that. And then all the preventive stuff. I mean, there's just so much that happens. So maybe focus gets lost on one area more than the other, or there's just not time spent doing some of those things. But I think the patients also have to kind of understand where the problems are too.
Yeah.
And that's hard too. It just requires so much patient education.
But fair enough, though. Part of your success for your son is that you're engaged, intelligent, paying attention, you know, asking questions, going out on your own and finding out more information. You're actively participating, if not directing his care.
Yeah, I would say both Tyler and I are very active in his care. And, you know, even, you know, identifying things like he's struggling with, you know, the fact that he's different and things like that. And what do we need to do to address that? That has been, we've been able to address that. And I'm thankful that we were. But yeah, I think that if we weren't in tune with him, that probably wouldn't have been identified.
Yeah. I actually just made a note for myself for a different series because it occurs to me that while it would not be easy to hear for some people, it might be interesting to get an anonymous doctor on a whistleblower episode and have them whistleblow on patients. Like, tell me, like, what is really standing in your way? If you didn't have to be polite, what is happening? Like, what are you battling against when you come into your job every day?
Because, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I bet you that would be eye-opening for some people too. Yeah. So that's interesting. So most physicians' jobs don't require communicating directions beyond maybe, hey, for the first 12 hours, put ice on this every 3 hours, or, you know, this is what this is going to feel like after your surgery, but don't worry, you're going to come back in. I'll check you. If everything's good, you'll be all right in 6 weeks. Like that's how most of this stuff goes. And that's our expectation as people, because most of our medical problems have gone exactly like that up until you get a chronic illness.
Well, yeah. And I think the other thing is that it's like an endocrinologist is kind of the directing the care, right? There's many other players of the team that provide information that's probably, you know, very, very helpful. Like the diabetic educators, they fill such a huge role, and it does take off some of the burden from the endocrinologist. And I think someone was asking me, like, you know, my endocrinologist doesn't seem to know a lot about how the different pumps work. And it's like, well, how could your endocrinologist know every single aspect about every pump that's available? That's why they have other people on their team to help with this. It's just, I think people might have an unrealistic expectation about how much one single person can do.
Maggie, is it unreasonable for me to expect that my endocrinologist spends a weekend figuring out the three major pumps and how they work?
Well, I think the three major pumps, I think that the endocrinologists do know that. They probably know one more than the other if they're, you know, more familiar with it for whatever reason with their patient population. But yeah, these pumps are really intricate and lots of different. You know, if you're asking, like, does this one, what about the, you know, I mean, first of all, the Omnipod 5 algorithm is still very mysterious. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, a lot of people don't know exactly how everything works. I think you know a lot about how the algorithm works, but it's all proprietary, right? And there are small, little tiny things that you can tweak that some endocrinologists probably know about, but I don't know if everyone knows about that.
You know, again, it comes down to communication then, because I have this story rattling in my head that I'll have to tell you so you'll know it. But I just had a person online tell me, or was it in an interview? Someone told me they were, kind of wrapping up at their endocrinology appointment. And the doctor said, hey, could you spend a couple of minutes longer? Can I ask you a question? And the person's like, yeah, what do you need to know? And the doctor said, can you explain how that pump works to me? And that, like, shook that person's confidence to their core about their doctor. And, you know, and I wonder if it wouldn't be as simple as saying, you know, because I don't live with diabetes and I'm only getting information, you know, from people in these short visits, could you spend a couple of minutes with me? Let me ask you a few questions about the pump. I'd like to dig down and get more information. If it was just said that much differently, then the feeling that that person left with wouldn't have been what it was. And the feeling they left with was, oh my God, my doctor doesn't know what the hell they're doing. Because that's the feeling they left with. And I wonder if that now was true or if the doctor just didn't do a good job of explaining what they wanted. Like, I don't know. I wasn't there, obviously, but
yeah. You know. I mean, I would have, before you explained your rationale for probably why that happened, I would have probably thought the same thing. I bet that doctor was trying to say, like, hey, you know this best because you deal with it every day. You're the expert. Like, what are some of the things that I need to know to better take care of my patients? But not all doctors are really good communicators. You know, I think there's a lot of room for improvement in communication just in general. But I suspect, you know, doctors all want to help people and treat people. That's why we become doctors. Hmm. They don't want to be, you know, providing some therapy that they don't understand how to do. And I'm sure that that endocrinologist or physician wasn't prescribing something they didn't know how to use. They just probably wanted that patient experience aspect.
Right. Yeah, I wonder that too, now that I think about it that way. You know, I think in the end, I think it is what it is. I hate to say it like that, but I there's people running around all the time. Like, how are we going to fix this? How are we going to get doctors to, I'm like, I don't think you're going to change anything. I think it's human nature. To some degree, there's going to be some better ones than others. There's going to be some bad ones. There's going to be some fantastic, you know, people that you meet along the way. And that communication, I mean, listen, if communicating was something everyone was good at, I don't think the divorce rate would be 1 in 2. So, like, you know, like,
yeah,
people are not great communicators in general. And just because they're doctors doesn't make them better. And I don't know that there's a, listen, Maggie, I'll say this. I think I'm a fairly good communicator.
Yeah.
I don't know that I could teach it to somebody, though. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not sure how to do that. Like, I think you learned from the podcast because I have a way of speaking about, what do? I do a good job of speaking about high-level stuff, but it doesn't feel high-level. I don't talk over your head. I don't actually have the ability to talk over your head, which is really helpful because who knows if I would or not. But I understand this topic really well. I speak in pictures, which I think people find helpful.
Yeah, but you also have the empathy. Like, you knew where you were and, like, you're trying to communicate to a person in that position.
Yeah, that helps as well, I guess. See, it's funny. I don't even know why I'm a good communicator in this specific situation. Like, so I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't know how we could expect some maybe rigid guy or, like, you know, some person, you know, some woman who's a little, I don't know, like, particular or whatever, like, you know, like, people's, like, personalities are all weird and different, or maybe they're very engineer brain-like, and that's why they're a doctor, and now all of a sudden we're expecting them to, like, get down on your level, commiserate with you, understand this really complex thing, and be able to communicate back the way to handle it. Maybe it's just not ever going to happen.
I mean, I think I have a rosier outlook.
Go ahead.
I am really a glasses half full type person. And I think that, first of all, having people hear these experiences is really important. Again, I think that if doctors heard that, you know, they potentially, their patients weren't seeing the results that they wanted to, and we think that it's related to communication, I think everyone would want to fix that.
Yeah.
I just think that there are so many constraints right now, and they're, you know, it's easier to say, like, well, I'm going to concentrate on the medical things, like make sure XYZ. And I have this diabetic educator who's really going to help with, like, the day-to-day, all that other stuff. And a lot of the education and a lot of the communication. And then this nurse is going to do that too. So I think that some of it does unfortunately get parsed out to other individuals. And perhaps maybe that's why, you know, the lead physician is really being seen as not communicating all that much. And so I guess maybe more of a teamed-based approach might change that perception.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. I'm going to ask this question a lot of physicians this year on the podcast, but what do you think of my idea about group instruction?
Well, I think that's great.
That would work, right? Instead of coming in for 15 or 20 minutes or half an hour at a time, what if everybody showed up and it was 2.5 hours long and it was a, you know, it was partly a Q&A and then partly while, you know, you could go off to the side in private and do whatever you needed to do with your physician while the Q&A was going on. Like, I think that would be such a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's definitely been shown. There's research behind that. I'm not familiar with the diabetes research, but in small group education in different disease states, there's a lot of research to support that. And I believe that they do something similar at the University of Chicago. I've seen flyers for diabetic education. They meet in the cafeteria and things like that. So there's a lot of research to support that. I think that's a fantastic idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I keep thinking it over and over again. It's this one simple idea that I have. If I am a person who, listen, between you and I, Maggie, you went to more like secondary school than I went to like regular school. So I barely like crawled out of high school. I was not an interested student. I did not grow up with a family who told me to be interested in academics.
Yeah.
And I bear, like, when I graduated, I was like, huh, I tricked somebody. And so, like, somebody right now is not doing their job giving me this diploma. And I'm out in the world, but somehow there's no other place right now. Like I'm sure there are hospitals that do a great job. I'm not saying that there's no other place. I'm saying that it's visible publicly. I speak to more people with diabetes than anyone else on the planet.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense sometimes, other than to say that this format works for a lot of people. And that the one thing I think I've done that I think everyone could do is that I've boiled diabetes down in my own head when I'm talking about it into a formula that anybody can understand when I'm saying it. And mostly what it gives them is a very firm base to start with. And it leads to outcomes and understanding that lead you to have, like, further education for yourself. Like, the outcomes I give you some understanding. You have those experiences, build on them, and get better and better at it as you go, up to the level you desire, I imagine. And that's, I think, what I'm good at. I think what I'm good at is talking about diabetes and boiling it down into understandable, digestible chunks. I think that's all I've done. I mean, if I've done more than that, I'm literally not aware of it. I don't understand why a doctor can't do that.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, part of, on a higher level, definitely brought together a community.
Okay.
And I think that that's huge. I mean, you've definitely, you know, distilled diabetes and made it a little bit easier to understand for lots of people. I mean, including caregivers, which, you know, that can be really hard for people that they don't live with it every day, mm-hmm. you know, but other, like, grandparents and things like that. But that sense of community is really huge. And I think that comes from that empathetic, you know, whether you're admitting that aspect or not, like, that there's certainly.
Oh, no, I have it. No, I know how you all feel. That. Yeah, yeah. I mean, to some degree, I know how you feel. And by the way, by interviewing so many people who have diabetes, while I don't have it myself, I might be one of the closer people who doesn't have diabetes to understanding what it feels like than many people, because I've had these long, in-depth conversations with people. And I am an empathetic person, so I do absorb. I do. I mean, it's hard on me sometimes, but I do absorb how they feel when I'm talking about it, and I maintain it. I will say, I think the community aspect is insanely important. I don't mean to minimize that, but if I was gonna say one other thing that I think that I'm doing that is leading to the success, it is something that a doctor can't do. And here's what it is, and I don't know if people know the secret or not. I put out an episode of this podcast every day. I create a world where there's always something there for you. And because everybody doesn't listen every day, like, some people do. Don't get me wrong. Those people are, like, they're my heroes, right? They're waiting for a new episode to go. You have any idea how many people tell me, like, hey, when's this coming out? Like, I don't have anything to listen to over the weekend. I'm like, hey, I'm doing my best, you know? But by putting content out Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and having it be a mix. This is a guy who's got type 1. Here's a woman who has type 1. Here's a mom. Here's a dad. Here's something with Jenny. Here's something with Erica. We're going to talk about the psychological sides of it. Like, keeping that stuff all mixed together constantly. Even if you're not up for listening to the psychological part of it, you might be up for management. If you're not up for management, you might be up for a story. There's always something there to keep you connected. And that connection is the somehow unquantifiable reason why people take good care of themselves. And I don't understand completely why it is, but I know if you're listening to this podcast, you're going to have better outcomes. And it's not always going to be because I taught you something about care. And yeah. I think that's true. And that's not something we could ask a doctor to do.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it. I think you're actually now teaching me what the podcast is, Maggie. I appreciate that.
No, yeah. I mean, I'm just explaining the way that it has been so helpful. And I think it is filling something. And I just, my view is, I don't think that a doctor is responsible for that. Like, it just can't happen in this day and age, maybe 40 years ago. But it's not happening. It can't. There's too many constraints. Things have gotten too complicated. diseases are more complicated. The management of these diseases is more complicated. There have to be other people, team members, you know, that are responsible for filling in these gaps. It's untenable for a single human to manage that.
Do that over and over again. And I can accomplish it because I don't actually have to sit down with each of you individually.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's interesting. But I guess it doesn't work. It's easy to say, can't you just do what I'm doing? But what I'm doing is having daily connections with people, and they can't do that either.
Exactly. I mean, right. I think that maybe this is, you know, just an experiment in that kind of group education and checkpoints and things like that, that I do think, again, I would fully support. I think that there are probably many other benefits, you know, even seeing that sense of some community in that setting.
Yeah. Oh, it would easily start like that because people would be like, oh, I live around here. And they'd start talking to each other. And I keep bringing this up, Maggie, over the last couple of years, because I'm convinced it's the answer. Like for institutions, I've said it on the podcast out loud, thinking somebody will take me up for it. I'll come out and give the talks. Hell, I'll come out for a week. We'll do it every day for a week. You bring in 50 people a day or something like that, and let the staff listen and hear
awesome.
Yeah, but nobody, in the end, what ends up happening, and this is not going to surprise you because you're in the game, but these conversations get pretty high at some institutions, and eventually what happens is, well, you're not a doctor, so we can't do that. That's how it gets shut off eventually. It gets to some level of the organization that goes, what's his credentials? And they're like, he almost got out of high school unscathed. And then eventually it goes away. So I don't know. I'm going to keep making the podcast and asking the questions. And hopefully someday someone does it. Because I think, to your point you just made a minute ago, I think I've proven the point. This works. Why is this not what we're doing for people? Because I'm reaching a lot of people, I can't reach nearly all of them. That's not possible. So I'm reaching the people who have an iPhone or an Android phone, have the time to listen to a podcast, know somebody else who would tell them about the podcast, or have the wherewithal to look for information outside of their doctor's office. I'm already limited to how many people I can reach.
Yeah. You know?
So anyway.
I do hope that it moves in that direction. I really do. I think it would be beneficial. And again, I think we would feel very isolated without, you know, having these, and I know Hudson would, we were lucky enough, again, one of the community members I already mentioned, the family with their eldest being a type 1 diabetic in hockey, the year that Hudson was diagnosed, they actually ran the first year of this camp that's dedicated to kids with type 1 diabetes. It's a hockey camp. It draws from Canada and the United States, and it's doubled in size. And Hudson has friends from this, he calls them his T1D bros, from this T1 timer camp. That's a bunch of kids that play hockey that have type 1 diabetes, and they text constantly throughout the year until they can't wait for the next camp session.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I think it's just really important.
Yeah, oh, that's awesome. And he's got his own little community as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, oh, that's great. Okay, well, Maggie, you were terrific. Is there anything I didn't ask you that I should have or anything we missed?
No, this was a pleasure speaking with you. And I really, really hope that your idea to kind of move things in the direction of that group education, I really do hope that it moves in that direction. I think it would be really helpful for so many reasons. And just want to thank you on behalf of my family and where we are now. You've really been instrumental.
I really appreciate that. If I ever have any problems with my pelvic floor, I'm going to call you.
Yeah, so, you know where to find me.
Yeah, 100%. I will tell you this on your way out the door. I just did a live event. I was in person somewhere. And they invite me out and they're like, you can come out and talk for an hour. And I was like, oh, not flying there to talk for an hour. I was like, let's do this. And I proposed this big idea. I said, why don't we do 4 or 5 hours? They're like, what? I'm like, oh, we'll give them a break in the middle to eat food. And she goes, no one's going to stay that long. And I was like, oh, they will. Don't worry. And so we did, I think we meet and greeted at like 9. I think we started talking at 10. We did a 2-hour talk. And I brought Jenny with me, by the way. I don't want to take anything away from Jenny. I could have done it on my own, but I thought, well, it would be really nice for people to see Jenny too. Let's have Jenny come, you know? So Jenny and I talked for 2 hours about diabetes. We just talked. And if I'm going to tell you, no slideshow behind me, No pre-planned idea of what we were going to talk about. She and I chatted for 5 minutes before we took the stage. And we were like, let's kind of start in this direction, see where it goes. And she's like, yeah, that sounds good. And then she's like, what about this? And I said, oh, good idea. And then we just started. We sat down, said hello. We started talking. 2 hours. Everybody went to lunch. At 1 o'clock, everybody came back. Nobody left. So we didn't lose anybody. And then from 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, and I think a little after that, Jenny and I just talked more and did Q&A live with the audience. That's all we did. And the next day, a person sent me a note and said, I don't think I've had a day go better than the day that we had after we left you and the day after. Like, so the next 36 hours after leaving that talk went so well. And we were at restaurants and traveling because we had to drive to come and see you. And all these ideas that, like, just being around the conversations and hearing other people's questions made light bulbs go off for even some people who never raised their hand. And that's what I'm talking about. That's what I think happens. I think you give them a podcast in person. I'm not saying every doctor's appointment should be 5 hours long. But if every 3 months you came out for a more targeted 90-minute conversation, and then you, you're going to have to figure it out yourself. But having that kind of like feeling and that experience for those people, they're going to take more from that than they ever would from sitting in an office and hoping that they remember to ask the questions that hopefully you have the answers to. You know, it just does. It's not ever going to work that way. So anyway, I appreciate you're very kind to come on. And what you said just now was lovely. I really do appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful.
It's my pleasure. Head over to Omnipod.com/juicebox to get rid of your FUMU. Omnipod.com/juicebox. Get yourself an Omnipod 5. A huge thank you to Eversense CGM for sponsoring this episode of the podcast. Are you tired of having to change your sensor every 7 to 14 days? With the Eversense CGM, you just replace it once every 6 months via a simple in-office visit. Learn more and get started today at eversensecgm.com/juicebox. I know that Facebook has a bad reputation, but please give the private Facebook group for the Juicebox podcast a healthy once over. Juicebox Podcast, Type 1 Diabetes. The Juicebox podcast is full of so many series that you want and need. After Dark, Ask Scott and Jenny, Algorithm Pumping, Bold Beginnings, Defining Diabetes, Defining Thyroid, the Diabetes Pro Tip series for Type 1, the Diabetes Variables series, Mental Wellness, Type 2 Diabetes Pro Tip, How We Eat. Oh my goodness, there's so much at juiceboxpodcast.com. Head up into that menu and pick around. And if you're in the private Facebook group, just go to the feature tab for lists upon lists of all of the series. Always free, always helpful. If you're not already subscribed or following in your favorite audio app, please take the time now to do that. It really helps the show. And get those automatic downloads set up so you never miss an episode. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back very soon with another episode of the Juicebox Podcast. The episode you just heard was professionally edited by Wrong Way Recording. WrongWayRecording.com.